Hello, I'm Guy Foster, and in this episode of the Bruin Podcast, we're going to talk about the impact of the US election again. This time, we're going to speak to Tina Fordham, who is a renowned geopolitical strategist, about what the lasting impact of the results is going to be. But obviously, bear in mind that we can't guarantee sources from outside Bruindolf, and tax legislation and allowances can change. And remember, when investing, your capital is at risk. Investment values can increase or decrease because of currency fluctuations, and future performance can differ from that of the past, all of which is very important to consider as we look into the impact of this momentous vote. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Bruin podcast, where I'm delighted to be joined on this occasion by Tina Fordham. She's a partner and head of political strategy at the advisory firm Avonhurst. She's got over 20 years of experience advising international organizations about global political developments and their implications for the markets and the economy. So an absolutely ideal person to be speaking to at this time when there is some fairly meaningful political news going on. So Tina, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Guy.
I guess if we could start off, I mean, I think we want to talk a bit about the election, but this week it's almost been sort of trumped, if you'll pardon the pun, by the announcement earlier this week about some real progress in the hunt for a vaccine. Now, I know that this has really kind of been the pandemic has been a big factor in terms of forming your kind of view of the immediate outlook. So I wonder if you could just kind of talk us through what kind of model you use to process that and where we are in that process.
Sure. Well, it's certainly a bright spot for all of us as we are in our second lockdown in London. And of course, the infection rates are going up just about everywhere in the world except for Asia. To have had this news that there may be a breakthrough on the vaccine front, it's certainly cheered markets. Now, as ever, I suppose, as a political analyst, I'm inclined to say, first of all, that the markets are really getting ahead of the process, right? And of just the sheer, if indeed this is the one, the rollout will take quite a long time. And if there is one, I think, really important takeaway from the pandemic and the way that it's tested governments, particularly in the developed industrialized world, is it's kind of exposed them as having pretty poor capacity when it comes to things like test and trace. And therefore, I think we can extend that to, really asking questions about ensuring that a vaccine, when it's ready, is actually rolled out effectively. So state capacity hasn't come out of this too terribly well, and it will also apply when it comes to the vaccine. But I think the sheer joy of a possible breakthrough is going to, give a lot of euphoria for now. And I think we all share in that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's really interesting. So I think it's a good segue then back to the role of government. And we've got government at the moment, I think, really doing more than it ever has done, almost in certainly my living memory, to support the economy, to support people. How does that impact on the sort of perception of government, of the trend of perhaps diminishing confidence in government, things like that?
Well, this is something that we probably need more data points in order to be able to understand. I mean, we saw many government leaders, even at the worst of the initial crisis at the start of this year, or the first quarter of this year, see a big boost in their approval ratings. And that goes for Boris Johnson, Emmanuel Macron, and even Trump saw some improvements. And we call that the kind of the rally around the flag effect. If this has definitely been a collective experience and a shared crisis, and the initial result is often to unify people in this sense of fighting a common enemy, and in this case, it's the virus. Well, moving along, kind of 8-9 months later, lockdown fatigue has set in. The trade-offs from quarantines and the virus fighting policies are significant, whether it's mental health or other public health issues not being treated as we focus on the virus. The question is when and how the citizenry might decide to show their displeasure with the leadership. We've seen a pretty small and fairly anemic anti-mask protests. Of course, you could say that all of America is kind of an anti-mask protest in the way that mask wearing has been politicized there. But one of the things I think has not received the attention that it might have about the US elections is it's possible to say that President Trump is the first political casualty, major political casualty of the pandemic. Given the, surprisingly robust turnout for Trump and for Republicans who maintained the Senate, of course, all of the key governorships amid record high turnout, still not higher than Joe Biden, you know, it might lead us to say that President Trump might well have coasted to a second term if it hadn't been for the pandemic. And so with that in mind, the elections coming next year might see more tests to how the public views the performance of leadership in fighting the virus. Fiscal loosening, yes, but still a lot of people losing their jobs and other, significant consequences, so that for many families, the pandemic crisis is having a much worse effect than the global financial crisis.
I don't know if this is fair, but I mean, because looking at how different regions have coped with the pandemic, it's pretty obvious that China has coped with it much better, despite getting hit with it much earlier than the rest of the world. And that's obviously a very distinct political system. I mean, am I right in thinking that Western leaders have been really reluctant to sort of try and undermine people's kind of privacy and all of the things that you might worry about in a more kind of a more Chinese system? And is that a big inhibitor to really dealing with this challenge?
It's a question that often crops up, whether authoritarian regimes are better at dealing with various types of crises. But in fact, it isn't just China that's done better at controlling the virus. It's a number of governments in East Asia, some of which are democracies or at least not as authoritarian as China. So Japan, South Korea, full-blown democracy, Taiwan, Singapore, they all have better records than the West. Now, I remember when the pandemic first really, came onto the scene, looking at WHO ratings for countries best prepared to manage a pandemic. And guess who was at the top? The UK and the US. Well, guess who really isn't at the top when it comes to at least the government response? The WHO charts were really much more about bed capacity and these sorts of things. So there's something more complex at work. We can look at other authoritarian democracies, like, for example, Brazil, appalling experience with the crisis. So it would be a convenient narrative to say that authoritarians, by being more willing to clamp down on civil liberties and freedom of movement, have a better record. But there's something more nuanced going on in Asia. I do think that the libertarian kind of instincts that we see in the Anglosphere, in the US and the UK, are definitely complicating matters. I spent time in Italy over the summer, and mask wearing was not optional. There was what I would call a lot more social cohesion around the imperative to enforce those kinds of behaviors.
So in terms of then thinking about the impact of this election result, then, I mean, what do you think does change about about US policy with a Democratic White House, but not a Democratic Congress?
Well, it would have been a lot easier to answer that question in years past, because divided government, meaning party control divided between the chambers of Congress and the White House, is something that financial markets have typically been quite happy about, because it constrained the legislative ability and maybe even the enthusiasm from Congress. In this case, I think very unusually, the first time in my memory, markets had got themselves kind of excited about a so-called blue wave, given the demands of the pandemic and amid hopes that you'd get a, you know, with Democrats controlling all three chambers, you'd get a more enthusiastic fiscal response. Now that's going to be tempered by Republicans, but I think on balance, the result is still pretty good for markets, pretty positive in that respect.
Yeah, I mean, I do wonder whether it would have been such a good result if you'd had a blue wave. Obviously, the markets had a fairly clear idea of what they thought they wanted ahead of the 2016 election. But when the results came out, they were again able to kind of pivot and see what actually did seem a much more market-friendly outcome with the tax cuts and less regulation.
Yeah, so if we assume that things go, you know, smoothly and to plan from here, which we shouldn't necessarily be so sure they will, this divided government outcome suggests, or, you know, going further, it means that the Trump tax cuts will stay in place. It means the Biden government won't be able to raise income taxes because Senate Republicans will block it. On the other hand, it means the big infrastructure spending bill that markets had hoped for almost certainly won't materialize, nor will the Green New Deal kinds of spending. So a mixed bag, but, you know, without the tax rises that are not very much appreciated by markets. But we shouldn't assume a smooth transition in the lame duck period, even though ultimately the US Constitution says that the president stops being president on January 20th, inauguration day, when Biden will take over. I think we should expect these legal challenges and the, for the first time ever, absence of a concession from the White House. And that isn't bothering markets right now, but it might start to if it drags on for a while.
Okay, that's interesting, because actually we had a previous podcast really saying that these legal challenges, they're not going to come to anything. The market's kind of right.
They're not based on anything, that is for sure. Each one is being thrown out one by one. They do seem to be buying the president time to do what? It's not quite clear. There's been suggestion, for example, that in the fundraising materials that he's continuing to send out, they're seeking campaign donations to pay down the campaign debt. That would be a cynical view, but there are no signs that the president and his supporters are looking to concede.
And so, I mean, I suppose another thing that as outsiders we look at the US and we wonder about is that obviously President Trump will be the president until fairly late in January. And we've got these COVID cases, you know, vaccine news may be positive, but for COVID cases right now are rising quite sharply. So, I mean, is that a real challenge for the US to have a possibly kind of fairly disinterested president during a period which could be akin to national crisis?
Oh, thanks, Guy. You've actually thought of something much scarier than what I'm normally able to think of out of my own risk analyst head.
It wasn't my intention.
Well, the idea that the incumbent might actually interfere with the rollout. I wouldn't want to speculate on his motives, but one of the things that we can expect is for more senior figures to be sacked in the coming months. On the other hand, the Biden transition team is starting its work this week, and fighting COVID is one of its priorities. So the transition team, even though it doesn't formally, you know, the president-elect doesn't take over until January 20th, they will start laying the groundwork for this. But, you know, one of the kind of bizarre byproducts of this very polarized time is that one of Donald Trump's sons claimed that it was the US funded Operation Warp Speed that produced the vaccine, which has just seen its, or we just saw the results yesterday. That's not true. This was entirely funded by German money, but the scope for conspiracy theories coming out of this, and competition between states is great. And not to be outdone, Moscow has said that they've approved a third vaccine. So here is another opportunity for countries to you know, project state power and engage in geopolitical competition through the vaccine race.
I mean, that's a really interesting point, and I think a hugely difficult one to analyze. So I'd love to get your sense of this. But I mean, the markets, as we described, very calm about this sort of transition, about legal challenges. But you go on Twitter and there is, you know, perhaps understandably, a huge degree of cynicism about when Pfizer made this announcement so soon after, you know, just what, 2 days after the networks had finally called a result to this election. Now, I mean, we can sort of dismiss that as being just a minority of conspiracy theorists, but is it something bigger than that? Is it a bigger problem for the US that I don't know how many people seem unwilling to accept that democracy has taken effect?
Well, I mean, let's remember that Joe Biden won more votes in the popular vote than any presidential candidate in the history of US presidential elections, that he has outstripped President Trump by several million votes. But what didn't happen in these elections that a lot of Democrats were hoping for was that Trumpism would be repudiated, not just that a Democrat would win, but that Trumpism would be kind of rejected by the US population. That hasn't happened, which is why in our coverage, we've said, you know, Trump is defeated, but Trumpism remains a powerful force. And in my view, there are going to be global implications for that. I've done a lot of work from a political science perspective about the drivers of populism, and low trust in institutions, whether that's, you know, the media, government, or business, is a major driver of this kind of upset. But whilst, you know, I think we all kind of look at Twitter from time to time and maybe recoil in horror. One of the things that I took a lot of comfort from in observing the US elections, in addition to that incredibly significant turnout, was how many people, you know, at the micro level in their local polling places, the vote counting, et cetera, took their jobs as kind of, you know, stewards of democracy incredibly seriously. And even in these very polarized times, I do think that's the majority of people. This has been a real stress test for US democracy, and we're not quite finished yet.
Well, Tina, I know your time is at a premium, so and this has been really interesting. But I think just before we let you go, I wonder, I think the perception is that under a Biden presidency, there's still going to be a difficult relationship with China, but a much more constructive one. I wonder if you could give us your sense of, well, firstly, whether you agree with that, and secondly, you know, what might that actually mean in practice?
Sure. Well, so the volatility emanating from President Trump's China trade policy, trade tensions, or some would say trade war, has been a major source of dislocation in financial markets in the last 4 years. And we really haven't seen China fulfill what it agreed to in the trade agreements. I think most observers have concluded that President Biden would continue to be tough on China. After all, it's traditionally always been US Democrats who've been the party who were, you know, the real so-called China bashers, given their historic ties to the labor movement and everything else. But I think what is really expected and hoped for, whether it's US allies in Europe or frenemies, like we might say about China, is a more predictable policy, set of policies coming from the White House. And let's remember that usually you don't see much change at all between US presidents and the conduct of really major elements of foreign security and trade policy. In fact, if we think back to the cusp of the global financial crisis, it was George W. Bush that had the US-China strategic dialogues. Those were then continued by President Obama in his two terms. It was President Trump who stopped them. So one move that we might return to is something like that kind of bipartisan mechanism to ensure, frankly, just good communication between the two parties. Because if you're not talking, there's at a minimum more room for misunderstanding.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks. Thanks, Tina. I really appreciate you taking the time to go through that with us. And thanks also to all of our listeners. Hopefully you've really enjoyed Tina's insight. And we really hope that you'll join us again for a future edition of the Bruin Podcast.